Our scripture this morning now is from the Old Testament, Ecclesiastes, the 5th chapter. I want to begin with verse 10, and actually go over to chapter 6, verse 9. Before reading, I want to give a rather lengthy explanation of what we're about to read. Don't usually do this, but I want to do that this morning. And I want to begin with two things I can remember seeing on children's playgrounds. Both things for climbing on. The first is something, and many of you may have seen this, is something where you climb up about 3 or 4 steps, and then there are a number of bars that are just the right height that you can swing. And the idea is, as a kid, you grab hold of these and then you swing like a monkey from bar to bar and you get over to the other end. And if you make it, then you get to climb down. How many have ever tried one of those things at any age? Good. You're familiar with that kind of thing. Right? And if you don't get to the end and you fall off, you have failed. Right. There's a clear goal to the full thing. Now, the second piece of playground equipment is one that I only saw one place ever. This was at Lake Superior, up where the camp sometimes went swimming for a while. And this was a pyramid of logs. At the apex, there was just a single log. And it was about 12 feet off the ground. And on both sides, you'd have that top log rested on two, and then two more, and then two more, and it went all the way down to the ground. It looked sort of like a military training piece of equipment. How many here remember that at Lake Superior? Only Alice and I remember it. It was, of course, taken out by the lawyers at the insistence of the insurance people at the insistence of the lawyers, because the great thing about this thing was, if you're a kid, you saw it and you instantly saw what to do, and you knew that if you made a mistake, you could get really badly hurt. That made it fun. And kids would climb up, and there would be a different kind of concentration when you know, if I make a mistake, I fall and really get hurt. Parents would divide into two camps. No, you can't do it, and stand there and watch anxiously. I was in the second category. In fact, I did it once myself, and I said, I'm too old for this. Now, Western ways of giving lectures, sermons, talks are all like the first kind of playground equipment. There's a place you begin, you get up, and if you follow all the way through, you get to an end, and you have a conclusion. And the great thing is the conclusion of the sermon. However, remember the other piece of playground equipment? Once you got to the top, then what did you have to do eventually? Get down. And it was kind of an anticlimax. The climax was right in the middle. You got to the top, and you sat on it, and looked around, and you were the king of everything, and you did it. And then you had to come down again very carefully. So the climax was at the very middle. What is very difficult for many of us reading the scriptures, and is very difficult for me, is to really grasp that a lot of times the Bible is like the pyramid. And the main point is right in the middle. And we want the main point to be where? At the end. Or sometimes at the beginning. I'll give an example of this that might be familiar. What's the main point of the entire Gospel of Matthew? Most scholars are pretty well agreed. This is where it is. It's right in the middle. It's in Matthew chapter 16, halfway through chapter 16, in which Jesus says to his disciples, "Who do you say I am?" And Peter says, "You are the Messiah, the Son of the living God." And Jesus says, "Flesh and blood didn't reveal this to you, but my Father in heaven." And the whole structure of the gospel is up to that point. And then the consequence is coming down from that point to the end. And you can see the gospel begins and ends with Jesus is king. All right, if you just remember the structure of the gospel. All right, everything's rest on Jesus is king, but at the very heart we have Jesus is king. He's the Messiah. All right, that's the structure of how that book is written. Genesis is actually written the same way. And the very center of Genesis is, and the almost, you might say, the point of this book is actually not in chapter 1. It's right there in chapter 23 or 24. God says to Abraham, take your son Isaac and sacrifice him. So Abraham goes off to do this, and then partway through, God says to him, no, stop. I have a substitute. And then right after that, God appears to Abraham again and says, I will give you this land. Now, the book begins with a wonderful place to live, Eden, and you get sent out of it. And the book ends with, you're going to be taken to a land flowing with milk and honey, just wait. All right, but right at the center there is Abraham on Mount Moriah, where the temple is later built. This is often the structure in the scriptures, and we sometimes miss what is central. Now, the book of Ecclesiastes has such a striking beginning that it's almost hard not to think of that as the whole point of the book. Vanity of vanity, says the preacher, all is vanity. All right, and it just grabs everybody who ever reads it, and you remember it. The main point of the book, though, is in chapter 5, right at the very end of chapter 5. Let me read from Martin Luther. This isn't any new discovery. Martin Luther, on verse 20 of chapter 5, says this. This statement is the interpreter of the whole book. Solomon intends to forbid vain anxieties, so that we may happily enjoy the things that are present, and not care at all about the things that are in the future, lest we permit the present moment, our moment, to slip away. Wait, doesn't he sound modern in some ways? Lest we let this present moment, our moment, slip away. In this way, a man has joy in his toil here, and here in the midst of evils he enters into paradise. On the other hand, wicked men and misers, and as many as do not follow this example in using the things of this life, begin already here to suffer torment and to be thrust down into hell. Now I'm going to, this morning, and I can't help doing this, right? I'm preaching like the monkey bars. The sermon is going to end with verse 20. And next week, I'm going to start with verse 20 and end with coming down the other side, which is verse 9 in chapter 6. But I want you to understand that the heart of things in this book is actually not in that striking beginning, which, by the way, is paralleled with the end. You know, the last chapter talks about getting old in the most vivid, picturesque language. You can't hear, you can't see, you can't walk, you can't chew, you can't sleep, right? That's old age described in the last chapter, and it parallels vanity of vanities, all is vanity in the first chapter. But the heart of how to live, the message, is most clearly stated right here in chapter 5. All right, so I'm going to read both parts of the pyramid, and we're looking at the first half today. Let's ask God's blessing on the reading of this word before we read it. Lord, we pray that you'd make us your humble servants of your word, and in this way, your humble servants, receiving at your hand your goodness and wisdom for us. And this we ask in Christ's name. Amen. Chapter 5, verse 10. He who loves silver will not be satisfied with silver, nor he who loves abundance with increase. This also is vanity. When goods increase, they increase who eat them. So what profit have the owners except to see them with their eyes? The sleep of a laboring man is sweet, whether he eats little or much, but the abundance of the rich will not permit him to sleep. There is a severe evil which I have seen under the sun, riches kept for their owner to his hurt. But those riches perish through misfortune. When he begets a son, there is nothing in his hand. As he came from his mother's womb, naked shall he return, to go as he came. And he shall take nothing from his labor, which he may carry away in his hand. and this also is a severe evil. Just exactly as he came, so shall he go. And what profit has he who has labored for the wind? All his days he also eats in darkness, and he has much sorrow and sickness and anger. Here is what I have seen. It is good and fitting for one to eat and drink, and to enjoy the good of all his labor in which he toils under the sun all the days of his life which God gives him, for it is his heritage. As for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth and given him power to eat of it, to receive his heritage and rejoice in his labor, this is the gift of God. For he will not dwell unduly on the days of his life, because God keeps him busy with the joy of his heart. There is an evil which I have seen under the sun that is common among men. A man to whom God has given riches and wealth and honor so that he lacks nothing for himself of all he desires, yet God does not give him power to eat of it, but a foreigner consumes it. This is vanity, and it is an evil affliction. If a man begets 100 children and lives many years, so that the days of his years are many, but his soul is not satisfied with goodness, or indeed he has no burial, I say that a stillborn child is better than he. For it comes in vanity and departs in darkness, and its name is covered with darkness. Though it has not seen the sun or known anything, this has more rest than that man, even if he lives 1,000 years twice, but has not seen goodness. Do not all go to one place. All the labor of man is for his mouth, and yet the soul is not satisfied. For what more has the wise man than the fool? What does the poor man have, who knows how to walk before the living? Better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of desire. This also is vanity and grasping for the wind. In a world condemned to vanity, how can we live? We do have our lives to live. So how live? And the message of the book of Ecclesiastes is, live this way. Reject all vain hopes that anything in this present life can give ultimate satisfaction. In particular, reject the vain hope that getting rich is going to make you a satisfied and happy person. Instead, take what God gives you from his hands. Enjoy these things before God, knowing that in the end all die alike, and wait on God for, and here we now go right to the edges of this book, wait on God for what will be true fulfillment, but it won't ever be fully there in this life. Let me go back to chapter 5, verse 10. Our writer begins with three proverbs, and they're all about the irony of wealth. Proverb number one, he who loves silver will not be satisfied with silver, nor he who loves abundance with increase. This also is vanity. The goal recedes. Now, lots of people have observed this. I'm guessing you could read something similar from the Buddha. You can find it in ancient Roman writers. Here's an ancient Roman writer by the name of Sallust. He writes, the love of money grows more as the money grows more. Do you love money? Don't be real fast to say no. Try the following thought experiment. Have you ever started a sentence in your mind that goes this way? I would be content if I owned my own house. You're wrong. How about this? I'd be content if I could sell my old rundown house and buy a new one that was just all fixed up. Then I would be content. You're wrong, you know. How about this one? I would be content if I had enough money that I could retire for the rest of my life and never have to work again. Guess who's had that thought? It's not true. That will not bring contentment. I would be content if I could buy a new car, just like the one Joe and Jan have, but new. You see, all these things we would say are, they're what money buys. All right, the point of the silver isn't just to run your hands through the silver, although there's a certain sort of tactile delight in that. All right, you get a bunch of silver coins. I don't mean the current clad ones. I mean the real thing, the real silver coins. There's kind of a clink in the sounds of them and a feel that just isn't there in our modern debased coinage. But even the good stuff, or the good stuff that the good stuff can buy, it just isn't going to bring satisfaction. And there's the irony in it. We work really hard for this, and we want it, and we want it, and we get it, and it's just never enough. Second proverb. When goods increase, they increase who eat them. So what profit have the owners except to see them with their eyes? The Philadelphia Inquirer every week has a listing of all of the most expensive houses sold in the Philadelphia area. Is anybody stupid enough besides me to look at those things? Okay, there are a couple. All right, good. All right, so I'm not the only one. All right. I look at these things and I say to myself, what if I owned one? How grand it would be. But then who's going to take care of the grounds? I've got to pay somebody to take care of the grounds because I don't want to take care of those grounds. Right? And who's going to clean all those rooms and all those square feet? Well, my wife, of course. right? But she says no. So I've got to pay somebody. Right? So the more you have, a different illustration. With each of my children, as they get to a certain age, and April 15 comes around, I help them with their income tax. And it takes me about 3 minutes to show them how to do their income tax on Form 1040 EZ. That's because they don't earn much. Then I come to do my taxes. Now, I'm grateful that I can't use the 1040 EZ. I'm grateful for that. But it takes so much time and effort. And you want to find this deduction. You want to find that deduction. And you do this and that. And you spend more wealth means just a lot more work. And it would be easier to just fill out the 1040 EZ and send the government, well, that's too much money. I got to do the work. And or you hire somebody else to do it for you. And then you have what you have here. When goods increase, they increase who eat them. So what do you profit if you own this great big mansion? You can look at it. Is the bed any better? No. Is the TV any better? No. Are your neighbors any friendlier? Probably not. But you get to look at it. When goods increase, they increase and eat them. Here's the irony of wealth. Third irony. The sleep of a laboring man is sweet, whether he eats little or much, but the abundance of the rich will not permit him to sleep. If you've never done agricultural labor, you don't know what tired is. My friend Don Piper describes his entire life as one of finding easier and easier jobs. When he was a teenager in the summers, he used to go work on the farms. He said, that was hard work. Then in college, he got construction work. And he thought, this is great. I get breaks. I'm allowed to stop and have something to drink. I'm allowed to go to the bathroom. This is really easy. Right? The farm work, you went out there to the field and you stayed there, you make a little lunch with it, you stop for a few moments, hope you found some shade under the tractor, and you went back to work. So he thought construction work was easy. Then he said, I was a school teacher. He says, now that was a great job. We said, but then I found the best job of all. I became a preacher one day a week. right. If you haven't done physical farm labor, you don't know what tired is. When we were in Cyprus, there was a guy in the church who had fields outside the village where he lived. Constantina was his name. And I used to go out and visit him. And whenever it came time to harvest the potatoes, that was hard work time. So I got it into my mind, you know what, we'll get all these kids from the town and the church, and we'll all go out and help him do his harvest of potatoes. And he says to me, Bill, this won't work. I was sure it would. And that's because I was 25. All right. He says, Bill, this won't work. I said, why not? He says, they're not used to the labor. I said, you're just bending over and picking up potatoes. Because the tractor actually would unearth them. Right? Your tractor would go along with a little tool and actually turn the earth over. So you didn't have to dig with a pitchfork. You just had to reach over, knock off the dirt, and put them in a basket. He says to me, I'll tell you what. You come out and just work with us one day, and then you see if you want to bring everybody else out. I said, okay. So Saturday, because I'm a school teacher over there, I don't work on Saturdays. So Saturday I go out there and they're harvesting from sun up until it's too dark to see. That's when they're working. So I go out there and I help him. And I've been running regularly. I am an athlete. I am fit. I have stamina. I can do this for about an hour and a half. Maybe two. I was so tired. Noon came. Oh, we sat down for lunch. This is great. 10 minutes later, it was time to get back to work. And these baskets were like this, right? I mean, this is serious harvesting. Great big baskets, about this big around, this far off the ground. And the only one who could lift those things full was him. And he was a great big man with arms like, well, you know whose. Had a good back. So he could actually lift these things. He says, do you want to work more or do you want to call it quits? I said, how about I call it quits? He said, okay, you worked longer than I thought you would. Yeah. He sent me home with a sample couple of potatoes. I have a few photographs you can ask me over at my house next time. One of them was this potato about like this. This was volcanic soil, and it was good soil. It was quite a potato. We have a photo of the potato next to Yanni's head. Right, and the point was, this potato is as big as the baby's head. The proverb's talking about a farmer. When it says a laboring man, it means a farmer. And the point is, he is so tired at the end of the day, whether he's had a big meal for supper or a little meal for supper, he goes to sleep and he has a sweet sleep. The guy who hasn't worked like that, he may be really rich, had a great late dinner, downed three or four glasses of wine. He ate the way everybody would like to eat. Now, when it comes time to sleep, though, he tosses and turns. Do you know, I had that trouble last night. We had so much good food here. When I went to bed at 10 o'clock, I lay there saying, I feel really full still. I finished eating a long time. And it took me a while to fall asleep. The irony of riches. Now, verses 13 to 17 have a story about a man who hoarded his wealth. So now we switch into sort of telling a story. And the writer says, here's something I've seen. Or let me tell you a story about an owner who kept riches and hoarded them to his own hurt. Luther's comment is this. What is a miser? But do you know that in America right now, does anybody inveigh against misers in the American society right now? I don't think so. Isn't that interesting? What's happened to American society that being a miser is no longer something that down through the centuries there's been criticism of misers? There's no such criticism in American society of misers. Odd. Anyway, what is a miser, writes Luther, in a society where they still criticize misers? What is a miser but a heart that is distracted by what it does not have and is turned away from what it does have? You see, a miser is somebody whose entire focus is on getting more wealth. Whether he's got a lot or a little really isn't the point. The point is, he lives for getting more wealth. That's the point of his life. When I hear sometimes politicians running for office and talking about the American dream, has the American dream died? Whenever they give it any content, nowadays the only content is, you can get rich in this country. And I wonder, it's got to be a little more content. But that's all I ever hear at this point is, you can get rich in this country. What is a miser but a heart that is distracted by what it does not have? Because you can never have enough wealth. And is turned away from what it does have. And can't enjoy what it does have. I want to tell you about something that I read in an op-ed page, and shortly after I read it, I remembered when I read it, I said, yes, this is one of the most wonderful things to have. And this was an article by a very hardworking woman who had a small child, went off and labored all day, and came home to her small child in the evening. And she's writing this this very interesting article, this is some years back, about a Saturday afternoon where she had time after lunch to just sort of flop on the bed. And then her toddler son fell asleep next to her. It was one of these summer days in Philadelphia when it only gets up to 78. You know, they don't happen very often, but one of those beautiful summer days when it's clear and bright and cool in the afternoon. And she describes, this is the most sweet sleep there is. And shortly after I read this, Mary and Emma and the grandchildren were down, and the joke on Saturday afternoon is after lunch, Grandpa reads to them until Grandpa falls asleep. That's how it works. And so I'm reading them with Mary on one side and Emma on the other side, and I'm reading them one of the happiest things that I do. And sure enough, before I gotten too far along, sleep won, and I fell asleep. And as I drifted off, Emma said to me, can I stay with you? And I mumbled, yes. So she fell asleep, little four-year-old next to me, and I fell asleep. Mary went off. A little while later, she came back, having found a blanket, and went to sleep on the floor. Distracted by what you don't have. This was time wasted, wasn't it? I could have been working and earning money. I could have been doing things. I could have been productive. And Luther says the miser just loses out on what he could have and does have because he's so focused on what he doesn't have. Here's an evil. And then what happens? Well, in the telling of this story, this particular miser loses it all through misfortune. Not because he got it illegally, just not because he was foolish. He just loses it to misfortune. And the scriptures have, of course, an entire book devoted to somebody who loses everything through misfortune. Robbers take part of it. A tornado takes part of it. Fire takes part of it. And Job is left with nothing. And Job, wise man, refuses to curse God and says, naked came I from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return. Blessed be the name of the Lord. His life, his hope, wasn't in fact bound up with all he had. And then, telling the story, even worse, having put his life into his wealth and having lost it all through some misfortunes, then he had a son and he had nothing to give the son. Do you know, there's probably no better way to have a bitter son than to have a son grow up knowing that dad used to be rich and somehow dad lost it. Anger at lost wealth. So one thing is certain about wealth. That's verse 15. As he came from his mother's womb, naked shall he return to go as he came. And he shall take nothing from his labor which he may carry away in his hand. Now verses 16 and 17, here is the irony. The irony is, he's worked to achieve all these. Let me translate this into current language. He worked to see achieve all his financial goals. I'm just curious, how many of you have financial goals? Good and bad is what I would say to you. Right. Good and bad. You know, if you focus too much on those financial goals, you may miss what you've got. If your life is bound up with those financial goals, you may never get the blessings God would otherwise have for you. If those financial goals, in fact, run your life, I'm going to repeat this. If those financial goals run your life, you are the miser that we're reading about here. And there's an irony. The irony is, get to them as you will never get there. Here's the irony. You can get to all your financial goals. You can then build bigger goals. And what profit will you have in the end? Well, he's now describing a man who was so focused on accumulating wealth that he ate in darkness. He wouldn't even light a candle to have light in his house. He ate in darkness. That's how he ate his dinner. And he had much sorrow and sickness and anger because he just put everything into his financial goals. And now the heart of the book. What has the preacher seen? Here's what I've seen. It's good and fitting to eat and drink and enjoy the fruits of your labor. How long? All the days of your life. Whatever God's given you, that's your heritage. And the particular picture is back to the dividing of the land of Canaan, where each family got its own piece of land, and that was its land on which to live. And there was no point in coveting your neighbor's land. In fact, you were told not to do so. There was really no point in trying to get more and more and more and more land. And now this. How do you have the ability to enjoy what you have? And the answer is, you actually don't have the ability in yourself. This is God's gift. God gives the ability and the power to receive and to enjoy and to be happy with the things that God gives you. Luther, in another place, and I'm particularly referring to Luther in this sermon because he had some interesting observations. Luther, in another place, talks about those people who were so focused on their financial goals, I'm going to use the modern way of saying things, that they wouldn't have children, or they made sure they only had one child. And Luther said, well, what is this? What is this? God says that children are a blessing from the Lord. God says that he wants children for a great and blessed offspring. What is this to be avoiding children because it gets in the way of accumulating wealth? He says, if somebody reproaches me, you're a poor man, you've got all these children. I will say, I am a rich man. I have all these children. Power to enjoy, ability to receive, the readiness to rejoice in all of God's gifts. This, verse 19, is the gift of God. And a man who's enjoying what God gives him each day, who's not doing what Jesus, we read from the Sermon on the Mount, what does Jesus say about worrying about tomorrow? He says, don't worry about tomorrow. I've always kind of liked what he says. I don't always follow it by any means. Don't worry about tomorrow. Tomorrow's got enough problems of its own. Deal with today's problems. This passage says, deal with today's delights. Take today, enjoy today, be happy with today. The other psalm I thought of singing today was not Psalm 49, but Psalm 118. Psalm 118, which at one point says at the very heart of the psalm, this is the day the Lord has made, and then what? Be glad and enjoy it. This is the day the Lord has made. Be glad and enjoy. We could have sung all of that psalm today very appropriately also with this passage. Now, why is this a gift of God to be able to enjoy your wealth? Because in our twisted, fallen states, wealth is always in danger of controlling us. That's why. So it's a gift of being free of that which we need. And it's a gift. It's a good thing in itself. And yet it so easily controls us that it becomes the master and we become the slave. But take as heaven sent to enjoy. And this is God's gift to humanity in general. In fact, Paul, speaking to pagans in Asia Minor in present-day Turkey, trying to explain that he is not Zeus, and that he is not Mercury and Barnabas is not Zeus. He says, one God made everything and he sends the sun and he sends the rain so that you may rejoice and be happy. Sometimes Christians think non-Christians are never happy. This is nonsense, of course. That's not true at all. He says, so that you can rejoice and be happy and enjoy these good things that God gives you. Jesus says the same thing. He makes the sun to shine on whom? The just and the unjust. This is God's gifts to mankind. And if we read this book right, that's the point. Yes, it begins and ends in vanity. We need to look beyond this life. But in this life, how then live? Live this way. Here's what I've seen. Good and fitting for one to eat and drink. Notice how this book completely rejects the Buddhist solution. The Buddhist solution is just suppress all your desires. Just suppress them all. Try to live without any desires, without any likes, without any loves. Live unattached. That was actually the solution of the ancient Greek philosophers called the Cynics. Cynics aimed at the same thing. Just suppress everything. Sometimes the monks did the same thing. That's not in the Bible. He says, enjoy your dinner and give thanks to God. How many of you give thanks to God before you eat? Good. That's exactly right. How many of you give thanks to God after you eat? We're like children. It's always more important before than after. You say please, right. How many of you give thanks to God for your house? Give thanks to God for your families. Give thanks to God for the weather, whether it's raining or whether it's sunny. We need them both. All right. Give thanks to God for your clothing. Do it from your heart. Yes, this is not the end of things, but this is God's gift, living in a world condemned to vanity. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. So how live? Not in constant moaning and complaining. Not at all. Live enjoying the good gifts that God has given to you. This actually has been repeated all the way through the book so far. Chapter 2, verse 26. Let me read it to you. For God gives wisdom and knowledge and joy to a man who is good in his sight. Chapter 3, verses 12 and 13. I know that nothing is better for them than to rejoice and to do good in their lives, and also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor. It is the gift of God. Verse 22 of chapter 3. So I perceived that nothing is better than that a man should rejoice in his own works, for that is his heritage. For who can bring him to see what will happen after him? And now in chapter 5, verses 18 to 20. And notice that in all this, suddenly these are the parts of the book where God is mentioned. Have you noticed that? Because we enjoy and live and walk before God. If we don't accept them as from God and don't live before God, then it all turns again to ashes. Now I want to read again from Luther, and I want you to note his comparison between paradise and hell and how we live. This statement is the interpreter of the whole book. Solomon intends to forbid vain anxieties so that we may happily enjoy the things that are present and not care at all about the things that are in the future, lest we permit the present moment, our moment, to slip away. In this way, a man has joy in his toil here, and here in the midst of evils, he enters into paradise. On the other hand, wicked men and misers, and as many as do not follow this example in using the things of this life, begin already here to suffer torment and to be thrust down into hell. Please turn to Psalm 49, Selection C.